My name is Lola Garcia-Alex, and I'm the Executive Director of the International Workgroup for Indigenous Affairs, which is called IFGIA. The acronym is IFGIA.
Yes, that's how I announced it today. So what is IFGIA doing?
What is IFGIA doing? IFGIA is what we call in our days a non-governmental organization. Although IFGIA was created or established in 1968, more than 40 years ago, and at that time the concept of non-governmental organization as such, it did not exist. IFGIA was created by a group of concerned anthropologists. Anthropologists who had been working in, particularly in Latin America, but also in other regions of the world, and anthropologists that at a congress that was held in Germany expressed their extreme concern about the gross violations, human rights violations that indigenous peoples were suffering at that time, particularly Latin America, when in many cases they were facing genocide. So this concern of a small group of concerned anthropologists raised the issue to discuss it with academic colleagues. And they were the rest of the academia were very, very skeptical. They felt themselves as academics and that those were political issues. Academics or anthropologists should do academic and research work and not engage in political discussions. So this small group of concerned anthropologists decided that something needs to be done, and something needs to be done to raise awareness about this extreme situation and make the governments in the Western Hemisphere aware of the situation of indigenous people. So they created what they call a working group, which is still our name. And of course, the idea, what they had at that time, it was to gather information, to share this information with people, to do what we call today advocacy, to really raise the awareness. And this is what the reason why IFGIA was established. And the reason why it was in Denmark, the headquarters of the office were in Denmark. It was not an office. It was one of these academics. He was a professor in the University of Copenhagen, and he had some resources through his students to do some work and to function as a kind of a secretariat for this small group of anthropologists, which they should send information. They should in order to gather it and compile it and do newsletters, but in a very primitive way. It was just on a machine. The Department of Anthropology. So this is the reason why it was established in Denmark, because it was around.
I see. I never understood why it was in Denmark.
Yeah, that was the reason. It was small as a because this small group of anthropologists, they came from different countries. They were not only, of course, they were some Nordic anthropologists. Even this professor in the University of Copenhagen, his name was Helge Kleven. So he was not even a Dane, he was Norwegian. And there were some Germans, they were from different countries. So the only reason that the organization or that this working group was based in Copenhagen is because he was the only one who had some institutional resources to provide or to compile and serve as a focal point for the group.
Because it is an international organization, isn't it?
It is an international organization. And of course, this working group developed. I mean, the first years, I would say during the 70s, it was a lot of this personal engagement of this group, you know, raising the issue, preparing newsletter, asking for meetings with the Nordic governments, mainly contacting indigenous peoples in the countries or trying to assess what was the situation. So of course, it's an international organization because it was never meant as an NGO somehow attached to a specific country, but as a kind of an international body or an international institution which gather information from everywhere and who everybody who could become a member or could contribute more than member, because at that time, as I said, it's not, it was not meant as an organization as we can interpret it today. But of course, the organization developed, as I said, in the 70s, it was a lot of this gathering of information and advocacy and trying to raise awareness, trying to write articles in the newspapers. I think also because these anthropologists were working quite closely with were related to some of the indigenous movements in the countries. So I think in the 80s, of course, when the particularly in Latin America, but it started a little bit in Asia, somehow the movement, the indigenous movement, established or their own organizations. So the whole another mandate or another way of supporting that this working group found, it was to support this emerging indigenous movement.
Was Yugia in fact involved in founding such organizations? Or?
No, not at all. I think it was a movement. I think a movement like related to the to democracies, to civil and political rights, and of course in Latin America, an emerging of this indigenous organization claiming for their rights, for the recognition. You start seeing in the late 70s, beginning of the 80s, some of these national indigenous organizations in Latin America starts to be funded, to be established. So if GIA was not, but if GIA was part of how could some engage academics, activists, could support this movement?
By giving them a voice, maybe.
I think bring in their own voices. I think if GIA also in the 80s, one of the things is trying to pay in the beginning of the 80s for they come to Denmark or to Norway or to Sweden, present their problems directly to the government. I think while in the 70s it was more gathering information, I think in the 80s if GIA's work was more how can we give them a space to bring their own voices. We can facilitate them or facilitate that their voice is heard. It's not if GIA the one only to be heard, but themselves can present the cases. And this was in line perhaps with the second main area of work I have talked about, documentation. I think in the 80s, if GIA saw another way of supporting this emerging movement also by monitoring and providing support to indigenous peoples to bring their cases to the international human rights system.
And how did you get into contact with this international human rights system? You just called them and said, we are a bunch of academics and we would like to have...
And as I said, it's not only FGIA. I think it was different people which at the same time, somewhere or another, came together. It was some officials, particularly one official from the UN working in Geneva. He was from Guatemala. His name was Augusto Williamson Diaz. He was working in the, I think at that time it was called the Office for the Human, it was not called Human Rights, the Rights of Men. And it was an office in Geneva belonging to the UN. And he was from Guatemala. He was very much knowledgeable with the Maya, with the whole situation in Guatemala and the atrocities that they were committed against the Maya people. So they were different people which somewhere or another share this concern on what to do. And particularly this person in the UN system, so to say, okay, how we can use the subcommission against discrimination, against racial discrimination. There should be a space there for indigenous peoples to bring their issues. And so he started as an official of the UN lobbying the members of this subcommission, which was a subsidiary body or the expert body belonging to the Human Rights Commission at that time. So he started lobbying governments there and trying to contact FGIA, providing them the information. Himself had a lot of information. And he was able somehow to convince this subcommission to deal with the issue of the situation of indigenous peoples.
It's because, of course, indeed, in the UN, all countries are represented, but many peoples do not have their own country.
Of course, that is at the UN level. But perhaps, I think, in at the 80s, still human rights, and in the beginning of the 80s in the UN, human rights still were considered an issue, an internal matter. I think we should not forget either that indigenous peoples had previously intended to address the UN about their situation. For instance, even I think it's in 1923, even before the UN as we know it today was established, it was what it was called, the Society of Nations.
Yeah, the Volkerenbond.
Yeah. So even there was an indigenous chief from Canada, which they had a big dispute with the Canadian government on land rights. So he addressed this, the Society of Nations, saying, "Okay, there's an issue. We are a nation. We are Canada. Is not recognizing our rights. Can you do something? This is not an internal, a national issue. This is an international issue." And he went to Geneva in 1923. He was in Geneva for more than 1.5 years lobbying, trying to get a resolution from the Society of Nations. But at the very end, they decided that it was an internal issue of Canada.
Okay.
And the society would not intervene. And this chief was not allowed to go back to Canada.
Not even? He was expelled?
Not even. He died on exile.
Mm.
So, the issue of later on, even in 1945, I think it was another attempt from the indigenous peoples from Bolivia to raise the issue at the UN. So the UN was not completely, it has been some attempts before. But I think, of course, the whole, in the beginning of the 80s, when the whole discussion of the whole issue of decolonization also, all this new discussion of what human rights were, what was the concept somehow, is established somehow the obligation of states to protect human rights and to protect, promote, and fulfill human rights. It came quite strongly in the agenda. So I think indigenous peoples, I think the coincidence of this emerging movement at the national level and somehow the openings in the international system, so give the possibility to indigenous peoples to bring their voices there.
Mm-hmm.
I think as everything in history, some way, of course, there is much, of course, related to the historical context at the moment and also some opportunities and some people that are in the right place at the right moment.
Yes, don't you think that maybe also there is a technical point that has had a lot of influence? I can imagine that you are working worldwide with people in very remote areas and that something like the internet has made a big difference.
Yeah, it is. It's very interesting to see that the developments. You have the 80s, you have the 90s, where really somehow you have all the discussion of an international, possible international human rights instrument, the declaration, the communication issue is much easier to communicate. Whatever happens in Geneva or whatever decision is taken, the revolution somehow, of course, has been on the benefit in many ways of indigenous peoples. So, of course, the level of awareness also, that has helped a lot. The level of awareness among indigenous peoples themselves and these communities on what are some instruments that they have. The level of awareness that they are not alone. That from my experience, I've been coming to the UN since 1990. I mean, one of the things that normally Ivkia has been supporting indigenous people from the different regions in the world to come to the UN in the 80s to present their cases, later on to follow the discussions and to participate and to contribute to the discussion on the drafting of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. But many times when people, when indigenous leaders comes to the meeting in Geneva, one thing that it surprised them a lot is, okay, this is the same, what is happening to us is happening to many others. You know, this building of a, this building of the global identity of indigenous peoples, the global identity based on, it's not only me, it's not only us, it's not only the Maya people or the Maasai people or the Ogiek people, or whoever. I mean, the problems are the same. They are referring, they have the same problem with the land. They have, you know, this, this kind of awareness among themselves, and we are together. We,
and do they get a sense, do they actually get a sense of being able to learn from each other or to involve each other? I mean, I remember when I was in Niger with the Waldabe people and I was trying to get them into this bigger context, and they were going to travel to a meeting in Ethiopia, and I said, yeah, well, and those people have the same problem, and they said, yes, so what? I mean, how is it going to help us that they have the same problem?
Yeah, I mean, it's true, but I think from my experience, what I see is not because, okay, and what so, they have the same problem. But my impression, I don't know if you talk to them after they have been in Ethiopia, and perhaps it's a, but perhaps when my experience from going to the UN to the meetings in Geneva, I think it gives them a lot of self-esteem and respect. You know, suddenly they are at the center. Suddenly, in that place, the problems are what is in the agenda. They hear a lot of strong voices. You know, that is the way they help each other. I mean, some people view marginalization through some the whole horrible history that they have behind. So suddenly, they are able to meet some indigenous lodgers. You know, all the argumentation, the legal argumentation. They get an enormous self-esteem. They feel respected. Even the governments in those contexts, you know, even the governments, which in many cases, if in their countries, they are not able to approach even governmental institutions, suddenly there they want to talk to them. They are interested. The delegation from this country want to meet with indigenous coming from this country. This is, I think, what I have heard, not only what I can assess. But
and are they actually listened to then? Because I see sometimes pictures of an indigenous meeting at the UN level, and then all of a sudden you get a lot of pictures, because, of course, those are very colorful pictures in people in nice clothes, you know, and I always get this annoyed feeling that people are more interested because it's an exotic thing than for the content, what those people have to say. Are they really listened to? Or do does everybody want to be in a picture with this nice man in this Sherpa outfit?
Yeah, but yes and no. I mean, the issue is what does it mean? The issue of going from good intentions to realities. There is a big gap. I mean, what is happening in the country, or what the commitment of a certain government in the country is, and another issue is what somehow the UN and what they express as their big intentions and all that. And there's a big gap. But at the same time, you say it's not only the colorful picture. I mean, indigenous peoples in the UN context have been able to achieve a lot. I mean, I think that they have been able to really to put their issue at the highest level of the agenda of the UN.
But it has taken some time, hasn't it?
It has taken 20 or 25 years or 30 years. But is the only group, I mean, as the, you know, bringing to the UN the issue of collective rights? It has been not easy.
No.
I mean, the issue of collective rights and the controversy on collective rights for all governments is not only indigenous peoples. Is much beyond indigenous peoples.
So could you explain exactly what is your definition of those collective rights?
I mean, collective rights is, of course, the UN and the whole international human rights framework developed by the UN after the Second World War, the big conventions and all that. They are based on what is called individual rights. As a person, you have some rights. You have some civil and political rights. You have some economic and social rights. And this, all these instruments that they were developed, they were based on the right of the person. You have, as a person, these rights. What, of course, the collective rights were in the UN context recognized, they say it very vaguely. They said all peoples has the right to self-determination. For instance, self-determination understood that the right to decide as a collective, decide your social, economical, and political system. This is a collective right. This is your right as a collectivity to decide about your issues. And this in the UN, main UN conventions, is recognized. The UN said peoples, but later on it has been always understood as state. This is the right of the state. The only ones who has collective rights is the state, is the state sovereignty. What indigenous peoples question, it was that. Say, okay, the UN, the convention said peoples. We are peoples. We are peoples that have the right to decide about our future, to decide about our economical, political, and social system.
Yes, even though we don't have our own territory.
Even if not, we have our own territory.
But not our own state.
It's not recognized. But it does not mean that we are against the state where we live or we want independence, perhaps in some cases, but normally it's not. It's the right, how do you use the right to self-determination, perhaps within a state. In some cases can be okay, according to that right. If our right as indigenous peoples, as peoples, is not recognized and is violated by the state, we have the right to say we don't want to be part of that state. It's. I think it's more the right to self-determination is the departure point for an equal dialogue with the state where they live. And of course, it's based, the self-determination is not just a political right. It's based on a territory, which indigenous people think. We are people because we are linked to a territory. Our social system is linked to a territory. Our economical survival is linked to a territory.
Mm-hmm. And the whole cultural frame is also linked to a certain territory.
The cultural frame, the religion, everything. And this is what they brought to the UN and said, okay, we don't apply to new rights. I think it's very important. One of the discussions that you always hear sometimes, even from governments and other people, why indigenous peoples should have specific rights. Indigenous peoples are not demanding, and now they are. It's not because they are specific rights just to them. It's the same rights that all peoples, and of course individuals also has. How do they apply to indigenous peoples?